And good morning. Welcome back, EAA Radio Live at the Welcome Center. My name's Steve Buss, and we got a full house here today. But I get the feeling they're not here to see me.
It's always good to see you, but welcome. Good morning. So is everybody having a great week? Well, I am. You know, it's fun to be around wonderful airplanes and people who love wonderful airplanes. And so that's the attraction for me, for Oshkosh. And it's good to be back this year.
Great. Now, for those not in person but are joining us on the radio or on the web, you may have recognized that voice. That is the one and only Sully Sullenberger. And we are pleased to have you as a guest on our show today. So,
well, thanks. You know, I've done a lot of interviews in the last year and a half. It was a mind-bending, life-changing, wild ride of a year, but a good one. And what I've discovered in all the television and radio and print things I've done, actually, I think people tell me I look better on radio. I've got that radio voice thing going on.
The radio voice, the face for broadcasting. I understand. Let's, you know, folks all know the story of the U.S. air flight, but let's go back a few years before that. What was the spark that got you involved in aviation to begin with? How did you come to be here?
I think I was born.
Okay.
No, seriously, I can remember being, you know, 4 or 5, and there were a few months when I was probably not quite 5 years old that I toyed with the idea first of being a policeman, and then being what was called a fireman in those days, a firefighter. But by the time I was 5, my family and I have clear recollection my path for my life was set. I mean, it was just obvious to me that I was going to spend my life flying airplanes. And my dad never flew, but he always loved airplanes, and he had books and magazines and things around the house. And the first model plane I built was one that actually came free as a prize inside a box of cereal. And it didn't require much assembly, but it was a little plastic silver model of Lindbergh Spirit of St. Louis. And all the assembly that was required was to put the wing on top of the fuselage. And that was my first one. My second model plane I built at about 6 was a Japanese Zero. And I remember, for whatever reason, it was molded in a light blue plastic, if I remember it vividly. And my third one was a Bell P-39 Air Cobra. From then I was hooked. I read every magazine, every book I could get my hands on, would hang out at the local airport when I got a chance. And I was just fortunate enough to actually spend my life doing, you know, what I was passionate about.
I've heard you tell the story of your first solo, and for those who haven't heard it, it's I think it resonates with most of us, remembering back to that first time we took flight without the instructor. Would you mind relating that story to our audience here?
Oh, of course, and it's one of those flights that's forever seared in my memory. It was Saturday, June 3rd, 1967. It was a nice day. It was late in the afternoon. My instructor had his own grass strip. He was a crop duster, but if he liked the look of you, he'd occasionally take somebody on as a student. And he had just mowed the grass, so you had that aromatic smell of the freshly cut grass. And unusual for that time of the year, it was a light wind, but it was out of the north, not the south. And we had made a couple of circuits, and then he said, "You're ready." And he got out, and he told me that the airplane would be a little bit lighter without him in it, and it would climb faster. And he told me to make 3 landings. And so I rumbled across the grass, did my checks, took off, and I felt this amazing sense of freedom, of independence. And I was determined to do it right, because I wanted him to let me do it again. And even though he wasn't in the airplane with me, I could still clearly hear his words as if he were there. All the things he'd said. Actually, he didn't say very much to me, but the few things he did say to me, I paid attention to, like use the rudder to keep the controls coordinated. And so I made 3 circuits, and I did them well enough I could continue. And in my logbook for that day, I put a little star by that. It wasn't a very long flight, probably about 9 or 10 minutes. I think I had 7.5 hours at that point. But then life was simpler then. We didn't have to know as many things before they turned you loose.
an amazing story. And once you had your certificate, you ended up in the Air Force. Was there something that made you head for the Air Force?
Well, my father was someone who had grown up during the last great financial upheaval, the Great Depression of the 1930s, which is an interesting story in its own right. I mean, they didn't have much money. His father, during tough weeks and tough months, would sometimes borrow money from him, and he always had extra jobs. But he ended up serving in World War II, and in my talks I say that, you know, they're called the greatest generation for a reason, for good reason. They too said that they too were ordinary people who found themselves in extraordinary circumstances. They too said that they were just doing their jobs, but as we know now, by just doing their jobs, they managed to save the world. I felt that same obligation when my generation began to come of age. I looked to my father's generation for guidance, and I felt that same obligation to serve that they did. And the Vietnam War was going on at the time, so he had his war, and we seemed to have ours. And it was just obvious to me that I should do my part. And since I wanted to fly, the Air Force Academy, and then serving in the Air Force, and if I could become an Air Force fighter pilot, I would serve as a fighter pilot. And in fact, I did. And I consider that still the absolute best flying I'd ever done in my life. I mean, there's just, I guess I've never done race car driving, but I guess I would equate it to race car driving on steroids. In formation. And of course, we were flying during the Cold War, where our tactic essentially then was to fly as low as you could stand it, as fast as the airplane would go. And so by the time I got to Nellis Air Force Base, my last posting outside Las Vegas, Nevada, where they have thousands of square miles of desert gunnery range, we would go down to 100 feet AGL. And that was just the legal limit. I'm sure there are times we were lower. And 540 or 600 knots. And 600 knots, if you haven't done the math, is covering 1 nautical mile every 6 seconds. That's 10 nautical miles a minute. So it's and a four-ship. And we were also practicing to do these things with limited communications, because we didn't yet have the technology to have our radios still work if we were being jammed by the Soviets. And so we assumed that we would be unable to use the radio, so we developed visual signals to maneuver the formation in any way we needed to without saying a single word in formation at 100 feet at 540 knots. Pretty cool.
I think that's the understatement of the day. Would be pretty cool. Once you finished up with the Air Force, then it's on to the airlines. How did you, what was your first position with airlines?
Well, I was very fortunate there also. I think, as I recall, there were only about 800 or maybe 1,000 pilots hired by the major airlines in calendar 1980, and I was one of them. I'd only been out of the Air Force about a week and a half, and I started ground school at an airline that was called Pacific Southwest Airlines, or PSA, in San Diego, which 22 years ago was merged into U.S. Air. And I was a 727 second officer, flight engineer, based in San Diego. And it was, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I mean, all of us, we looked like clones. We were about 29 or 30 years old with three-piece suits and short hair and college degrees. And I think every single one of my class of 8 was former military, which is not typical today. And we were very happy to be there. As long as they gave us a seniority number, they could have painted us yellow and used us for chalks, and we wouldn't have cared.
Was there someone at the airline then who acted as a mentor for you when you were just starting?
Well, he certainly had no lack of influence. We were in a three-pilot airplane, the 727, and so that was another way to gain experience. Before you even took the controls, you're sitting sideways in the panel, and you're watching the captain, the first officer, work together. And I did that for 3.5 years before I got my window seat. And you watch, you learn, because it's airline flying is very different than military tactical aviation. It's not as hard in some ways. It's challenging in others. What was thrilling and required absolute precision about and discipline about military flying was very satisfying. But the teamwork in the cockpit and the striving for smoothness and for efficiency, and the decision-making process about handling risk, managing risk, was part of what was so interesting about the airline flying, and that's satisfying in its own way.
You've had a long career in the airline industry. How has the industry changed? I mean, aside from the obvious economics, things like that, mergers, but actually in the cockpit, the way that the crews interact, maybe in the early days compared to now.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. It's changed a lot, and mostly for the better in the cockpit, not so much outside the cockpit. It's certainly safer than ever. It's cheaper than ever. But it's changed completely. It's changed in the good way, in that 30 or 40 years ago, there were captains who might be cowboys or gods, and they would rule their cockpits by whim with insufficient consideration of best practice or standardization. There were a few who didn't use checklists. There were some who would insist on getting their own gear and flaps instead of using a team concept. There were some who would cut a wide swath around thunderstorms, and some would find a way to go through a line. There were some that would took 5,000 pounds extra fuel in every flight, and some that would want to take just the minimum. And sometimes first officers would carry their own little personal notebooks and keep track of these personal preferences, and woe would be to any first officer who didn't remember a particular captain's preference. And in the bad old days, 40 years ago, when a crew member would confront a captain about an unsafe practice, he or she put his or her job on the line. Thankfully, those days are long gone. In the 50s and 60s, we certainly made great strides in technology with transitioning from piston to jets, made a quantum leap, an order of magnitude increase in reliability and safety. By training and by using flight simulators instead of using actual airplanes for training, we avoided trainee accidents. In the 70s and 80s, using technology and training, we solved the problems of wind shear, collision avoidance, icing for the most part, controlled flight into terrain accidents for the most part. And then in the late 80s and 90s, with crew resource management, CRM, we attacked the human performance issues, and we've gotten even greater benefits out of safety from that. And prior to January 15, 2009, one of the things in my life of which I was most proud was my direct involvement, my early involvement at my airline with the introduction of CRM. And I taught the very first crew resource management course at my airline in the late 80s in our training center in San Diego. And we had, just to show you how far culture-wise we had to come, at first we had to convince the pilot safety committee it was a good idea to do this, which is mind-boggling when you think about it now. But at first, it was thought to be a threat to captain's authority, to our autonomy, our independence to make a professional judgment. But of course, that turned out not to be the case. In fact, CRM makes you a more effective leader. You have more resources available to you if you open those channels of communication and you act as a team instead of a collection of individuals, and where the first officer is empowered in our crew. If they see something that the captain is not fully appreciating or might not know, it's not only their responsibility to speak up, it's their right to speak up. So we've come a long way since those days. Obviously, economically, that's not the case. We've been hit, like many other industries have, by an economic tsunami of change. We've lost our pensions. We've been had our pay cut in half. And so it's not the job that it used to be, but it still requires people who are passionate about aviation and who have the dedication to always try to make the next flight better than the previous one.
We're talking with Sully Sullenberg, and you are listening to EIA Radio. We're live from the Welcome Center on EIA Radio.
Celebrating aircraft home building and innovation, this is EIA Radio in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And thanks for joining us at the Welcome Center on Celebration Way. We're talking with the man simply known as Sully. We're talking airlines just before the break, and you made a comment about the airline industry.
You know, that we're hearing some jets go by right now, and I remember when I was checking out the F-4 at Luke Air Force Base in Phoenix in the mid-70s, there were just beginning to be some noise complaints made around the air bases. And so some of the fighter pilots in the Air Force created their own bumper stickers they put on their cars that said, "Jet Noise, the sound of freedom."
Indeed.
Or they would say when a noisy jet went over and somebody complained about it, they said, "Don't worry, it's one of ours."
Yes. In the previous segment, you mentioned the airline industry making the transition from props to jets. And yesterday, you made the transition from jets to props, didn't you?
And it was a wonderful one. And First Officer Jeffrey Skiles and our Administrator Randy Babbitt and others got to ride on the DC-7. And I had never ridden on a DC-7 before. I'd been on the occasional 4 or 6 or Connie years ago as a passenger, but I'd never been on a 7 and always wanted to. It's obviously the epitome of the prop liner age. And the one word I used after the flight to describe it was magnificent. It was just the cat's meow. It doesn't get any better than that. The sounds of those big radial engines, seeing those props and the polished spinners, and cruising along in grandeur is beyond belief.
We're talking about the DC-7 that's here out on Aeroshell Square. Historical Flight Foundation out of the Miami area operates that airplane, and they were kind enough to take you along.
Yes. They were. A big thanks to all of them.
Yes.
And to the administrator for helping enable it with the regulatory approvals they needed.
Yeah, they went through quite a, not a struggle, but it was an interesting process to get that airplane airworthy.
It was
again.
A journey.
A journey. Because there are not a whole lot of folks who are current in the DC-7 these days, so just training up the flight crew was an interesting challenge. But for someone who flew F-4s at 100 feet off the ground and 600 miles an hour, what was the appeal of something like a DC-7 that goes a lot slower and maybe flies a little higher?
Well, I mean, it's the same passion for that. I mean, there's so many aspects to aviation, I think, and we're appreciating our heritage and understanding our history when we have the wherewithal and the desire to preserve it and to preserve such a magnificent artifact. And I use the word artifact because it includes the art as part of it. It's as much science as art to create something like that. That's that magnificent. And I think it also is a throwback to what we have, at least in our minds, as an idealized notion of a grander way of travel, a more civilized way of travel. And my first airplane ride occurred when I was probably about 11 or 12 years old, and I accompanied my mom to a statewide PTA convention. We flew from Dallas Love Field, the downtown airport, to Austin Mueller, which no longer exists, in a brand of Piston Convair. And of course, she wore her best dress and a hat and white gloves. And I got a window seat, and I had on a blazer and a tie. And it was just the way people showed respect for each other and for the mode of transportation.
Well, you mentioned your first flight being in a Convair. Of course, that kind of transitions nicely into what you're doing now with being a co-chair for the Young Eagles program and helping provide kids with their first flight. What was the initial reaction when Tom and Harrison Ford asked you if you and Jeff would be interested in taking over the program last year?
Well, it was a great honor to be asked, to be thought of as being suitable or capable of such a thing. But I obviously knew intuitively that it was very important to do. I will tell you that my wife's first reaction when she had a chance to meet Harrison Ford was that she turned to him and in sort of a half-joking way said, "What have you gotten my husband into now?" But she understands completely, and it was wonderful for her to meet him. But, I look upon Young Eagles as being in the passion business and the connection business. We find people who have that passion, and we connect their desire with opportunity. And we are doing nothing less than ensuring the future of aviation when we do that.
You also had an opportunity to fly some Young Eagles recently. We had something arranged for International Young Eagles Day, and you were weathered out, so was Jeff. But you did get the flight in a couple of weeks ago.
We did. So on June 12th, we attempted to fly, and on July 12th, we in fact did. But, I use that as an object lesson, too. Part of what we're doing is we're mentoring people. We're trying to model for them the kind of behavior, including the professional behavior, that we hope that they will internalize. And so I told them on June 12th at the Hayward Airport in California, when the wind was a direct crosswind, about 23 up to about 29 knots, I said, we're not going to fly today. We're going to wait until the conditions are more favorable to give you a very positive, a very pleasant experience, and that the risks outweigh the rewards. And that managing risk, and that managing risk is a big part of what pilots do.
You also will be flying some young Eagles later today, this afternoon, so we're looking forward to that. But as the Young Eagles program is evolving, and we're adding more options and pathways for kids to get into the cockpit and continue on, what are some of the things you would like to see in the future for our Young Eagles program?
Well, we already have a lot of programs in place, and I'm very happy that Jeffrey Skiles, my first officer from the January 15, 2009 flight, and my co-chair with Young Eagles, has had many ideas about scouting initiatives, about training initiatives. Hal Shippers of Sporty's Pilot Shop has stepped up to the plate and really made a huge difference. All our sponsors have. So we're finding new ways all the time to get more people involved and to connect all the dots. Once they get that first Young Eagles flight, to take them on from there to completion of a private certificate and on beyond. And what we're really doing by ensuring the future of aviation is we're helping people to attain goals, whether that goal is to be a recreational pilot or to be a military pilot or a corporate pilot or an airline pilot or a pipeline patrol pilot. In whatever way that they choose to pursue aviation, we're trying to facilitate that. We're trying to provide them a glimpse of their possible future, whatever it might look like.
Now that you've been here, this is your second year at AirVenture, what are the sort of things that stand out? Last year, I'm sure, was just sort of an overwhelming experience and trying to figure out where everything was and who everyone was. But what about this year? What, any events or airplanes that are sort of highlights so far?
Well, certainly the DC-7 was a highlight. Seeing the F-4 fly was a highlight. The last time I flew an F-4 was February 12, 1980, so it was 30 and a half years ago. So good. Seeing that airplane fly and hearing that noise again certainly got my attention. But, you know, making more connections with people throughout the industry at all levels and all different kinds of organizations, that's been the most important thing, realizing how much we share this common passion for aviation, whether we're suppliers or enthusiasts or no matter what organization, it's just making those connections that keep this organization strong.
You also had a chance to fly the Ford Trimotor yesterday.
I did.
What was that experience like? A little different than an F-4 or a 727?
Yeah, the Trimotor is kind of like one of those airplanes where you take off at about the same speed, you cruise at the same speed, and you land at the same speed, which that works too. You know, it's you're consistent that way. It was a lot of fun, and your windows are open, you're close to the ground, and of course this beautiful Wisconsin countryside underneath you. It doesn't get any better than that.
Are there any other airplanes that you're hoping that you'll have an opportunity to fly someday?
Well, you know, I felt like Christmas came early this year when I talked to Tom Pobresny, and he managed to help set up the ones he did. But gosh, since you asked me, Tom, are you listening? There is a Concorde out there, and one never knows. Dream big.
There you go. We've been talking mostly aviation, but your life has changed significantly since you splashed down in the Hudson. You went to the Super Bowl and met the president, all the hoopla that even continues today. You've written the book, book tour, lots of things. Your wife mentioned your personal life, and that made the big news as you were a rock star. But how has it changed in the way you've been able to take on a cause like Young Eagles? Have you been active in other charity causes or advocacy work?
Yes, and our attitude, this was such an intense, life-changing event in an instant. Our attitude was very, very simple. If we supported it before, we're going to support it after. If we were friends before, we're going to be friends after. We're trying not to let this event change us, although it certainly has changed the way that we've had to learn to live our new lives. But the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis is a group that we've supported, although modestly, before, according to our meeting. Last May, a year ago, the first time I had a chance to visit St. Jude's in Memphis, meet the staff, meet some of their patients and their families, and talk about courage. I mean, young children facing life-threatening illnesses with grace and with dignity and great courage. It's hard to imagine. And so I did a couple of commercials for them. And one of the things I've been most proud about in the last year is how many people have come up to me and said, I saw your commercial. I was watching the Golf Channel or something. I saw your commercial and thank you for doing it. Thank you for supporting such a good cause. And I've gotten word back that their campaign, that this commercial has been very successful and has raised lots of money for St. Jude. So thank you for your help if you have done that. And also, we've been long supporters for a long time for Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, north of the Golden Gate, near the San Francisco Bay Area. We've had four different breeding dogs for them. My older daughter has raised two puppies for them. And one of our neighbors who lost his sight a few years ago now has a guide dog from Guide Dogs for the Blind. So it's groups like that that have always been a lot to us, like EAA and aviation groups that we try to support.
That's fantastic, and thank you not only for supporting Young Eagles and EAA, but also for St. Jude's and the guide dogs. It's every little bit helps, as they say.
It's a chance to make a difference with this, to use this opportunity for good.
We've just got a minute left. Any thought that you'd like to leave the crowd here with today?
Well, for all you kids, if you love airplanes, follow your dreams and be willing to work hard to make them reality. And for everybody else, enjoy the rest of your week at Oshkosh. Thank you for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sully Sullenberger, co-chairman of the EAA Young Eagles program. Thank you all for being here at the Welcome Center. Thank you for joining us at home and on the radio. From the Welcome Center on Celebration Way, I'm Steve Buss, and this is EAA Radio.